Jesus, please don't be mad. I know that it makes you sad when I simply don't obey.
Welcome to Face of Appalachia, hidden stories of faith and value. I'm Rob. I'm a priest and chaplain. As we explore personal stories, we're trying to uncover something. There's a myth of the region in Central Appalachia being monocultural, and that has just been not my experience. Mm-hmm. I have encountered people of rich story, rich values, and pretty unique, and as soon as you lift them up and people say, I can't believe that's in, you know, that's in your region. So when you think of Central Appalachia, of course, you think Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, Southern West Virginia, and I want to especially thank Kentucky Humanities, National Endowment for Humanities is our grant sponsor. But I'm excited today, a person I really admire who I think is doing incredible work in an area that most people kind of forget about.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You got to be really intentional to get to Welch, West Virginia.
Yeah, you have to want to come here. To get it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, brother, introduce yourself.
Well, my name is Reverend Brad Davis. I am a United Methodist clergy person serving here in what we like to call the free state of McDowell County. I serve five churches here in the county.
Five churches.
Was six when I first got here. And one, unfortunately, we had to close one.
Sure.
But so I have what's known in United Methodist circles as a five-point charge. Where I kind of serve as the presiding elder of the charge. And yeah, it's five different communities, five different challenges, really, in these communities. But I love it here. I tell people all the time that this is the greatest place on earth and with the greatest people on earth.
Mm.
I'm a Coalfield kid. I grew up, I was born and raised in Mingo County, which neighbors here.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a McDowell native, but this is very much home to me.
Yeah. So you grew up, I mean, just about how far is it from your house to here, from where you grew up?
Where I grew up is like 65 miles as the crow flies. it'd take you about, it's about an hour and a half drive, hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, so you're close.
But I'm close by. So which is great because my parents are still in Williamson, my brothers, my family is still there. If I need to, I can just go up the road anytime, and I get up that way fairly often to visit with them. So that's cool.
Okay, so you're like the preacher, pastor, guy who does communion, do all the baptisms, the pastoral care, a lot of different areas. And would that be kind of? I mean, are you kind of like in some ways, kind of like a chaplain of the area too, because you're involved with all the different churches?
Well, yeah. Well, it's funny you should say that, because in our tradition, we are appointed by our bishop not only to a church in a particular community, but our charge also includes the community as well. So I very much view myself sort of as a chaplain of the communities that I serve, which is why I am so intentional about getting involved in community action, addressing community concerns, needs, challenges, because I view my work and the church's work in a lot of ways of trying to do whatever we can to uplift communities, uplift life in those communities in any way that it needs to be lifted up.
Mm. Well, you already mentioned the kind of a bishop and kind of appointment and all this. So it seems like being a United Methodist is kind of an important part of your spirituality.
Absolutely. I tell people that I'm Wesleyan to the core. I have Wesleyanism in my DNA.
Wow, so, that's a big statement.
And honestly, I didn't come to the faith until 2005, and really become really involved in the church at that point. But when I started to dive into the history of Methodism and Wesleyan theology, I'm like, I'm truly at home.
I've come home, right?
I'm truly at home.
So when, when you said you came to faith, or kind of came to the faith in 05, like, how did that happen? Like, you were you, like, about roughly about how old were you when you kind of started? Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I would have been 33 at the time. And, you know, my mom has been a lifelong Methodist. So, you know, all throughout life, she, or my life, and, you know, as a kid, I did all this VBS, Sunday school, all that type of stuff. But I kind of, you know, wandered away, didn't stick with it. But she would stay on me. You know, you should come to church with me. And I always blew her off. But in 05, leading up to Easter in 05, I just felt like I needed to go to church with my family. Mm. And in hindsight, looking back at that, I know that was the Holy Spirit prodding me and leading me in that direction. And so, as I like to tell people, sitting in my home church in Williamson, West Virginia, on that Easter Sunday morning, even though I had been in, you know, countless church services prior to that, that was the first time where I felt like, number one, I was home. And number two, God was trying to get my attention at that point.
Okay.
From the time I sat down in the pew until I got up to leave, it was like the whole service was oriented towards me.
Wow.
Like that I was, that everything was directed at me, that God was like speaking directly to me.
Wow, that's pretty
good. And that initiated my whole conversion experience.
Wow. Yep. So that Sunday, then you just got up and said, okay, now I'm going to be United Methodist pastor.
No, it didn't quite work like that. So actually, so quick story, as I was going through this process, this extended conversion process, I would be around friends of mine or even folks who really didn't know me that well, and they would, not even knowing who I was, mistake me for being a minister.
Interesting.
And I was like, what are you talking about? You're crazy. No, I'm not a pastor. I'm not a minister. But so not long after that, actually just several months after I really started to be involved in the church, my pastor at the time, Reverend Greg Blair, who was no longer with us, unfortunately, I was in the parsonage one day with he and his wife, and he mentioned the fact that he was getting ready to go out of town in a couple of weeks and he was going to miss a Sunday. I said, well, who's going to fill the pulpit for you while you're gone? He's like, I don't know, it might be you. And it ended up being me. He asked me to do it. So I say all that to say that it was really him, Reverend Blair, my pastor, who recognized the call on me way before I ever realized it. And he kind of nudged me in that direction.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So you, I mean, he saw what God was doing.
Yes.
You say yes.
Yes.
And you start. And then when that first Sunday when you preached, did it feel like natural or did it?
It did. Which oddly enough, you know, growing up all my whole life, I was terrified of public speaking.
Really?
Oh God, it horrified me. I hated to get up in front of people and talk. But it was very strange when I got up in the pulpit and nothing, no anxiety. No. Now, granted, the sermon was probably trash.
Oh, sure, it's our first ones, right?
Right, and way too long. But yeah, I mean, it was really astounding to me that I was able to get up in front of people with no hesitation and speak.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Usually you hear these stories of knee knocking and all that, but it was just
duck
to water kind of thing.
It was almost like, I liken it to like stepping up into the pulpit, behind the pulpit, and almost like plugging into a power source.
Wow.
that's beyond me, right? It wasn't me.
Right. You, I mean, obviously yes. The Holy Spirit's really
Absolutely.
Doing something in you.
Yes.
So you start this journey of saying, and is that when you recognize, like, I'm not just going to be a person in a pew, like I'm going to have to be a pastor?
Yeah. So I knew at that point that I was kind of reasonably certain that I was called to preach. Now, pastoral ministry, I wasn't sure about.
Okay.
I was like, yeah, you know, I'll continue to be a lay speaker in the church, fill pulpits when pastors are out of town. And that's kind of what happened in the United Methodist Parish in Mingo County, because we all worked together. We had a very active parish. Mm-hmm. Anytime any of the pastors would go out of town, most of the time they would call me to fill their pulpit.
Okay.
So, which allowed me to get to know all these folks really well. But... So going to annual conference, though, okay. I think it was 07. Okay. It could have been 08. I'm not sure. But I think it was 07. Our bishop at the time, Bishop Ernest Light, at the end of one of the worship services, and this was in Buchanan at West Virginia Wesleyan College, he gave an altar call at the end of the service for anyone feeling called into ministry. And I felt like I needed to go up front.
Okay.
And that was really when, and not shortly thereafter is when I declared my candidacy for ordained ministry, ended up going back to school to finish my undergrad degree.
Okay.
Eventually ended up going to seminary, first licensing school, then seminary.
Wow.
And which all of that has led me here to where I am now.
Wow. So, I mean, so really, from that moment until your ordination, were like, what, 13-ish years?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, at the time, I was caring for my grandmother.
Okay.
Who I lived with her and was her primary caregiver for the last 8 years of her life as she dealt with dementia.
Oh, wow.
So that was why there was some gaps and why it took so long.
Sure.
For me to end up being ordained. But yeah, I got ordained in 2023.
But still, I mean, I just think that's amazing that you have this sense of call, this like, I'm going to preach. And I mean, it's a lot of hard work. I mean, undergrad,
yes.
Licensing school, seminary is no joke. I mean, that's a lot of work for the sense of like call and purpose that you were being awakened to.
And until I went to seminary in what year was that? 2017. Until I went to seminary, I was bivocational.
Okay, so you're working full-time, doing that, okay.
Absolutely. So, it was a lot of work.
Wow.
It takes quite a commitment to follow through on that. And in addition to schoolwork, like your undergrad work, and then when you get into seminary, obviously, you know, graduate-level work is tough. You know that. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, all of the hoops that you have to go through in the ordination process, too,
mm-hmm.
like going through the Board of Ordination requirements is a whole heck of a lot of work as well.
So that's not just like, I mean, you know, and a lot of people are used to, you know, let's say I feel a call, I get up, I tell the church, and the church watches me for a while, and then they put their hands on me, and okay, I'm ready to light the pulpits up. This is not that. This is like outside boards and paperwork and papers and...
All of that, yes.
Wow.
Interviews.
Interviews, okay.
Yes.
Psychological tests.
Psychological tests, yes.
Wow.
And I'm not going to reveal the results. Don't ask.
Yeah, don't ask. It's better not to know. Better not to know. So you are staunchly in what they call the mainline tradition.
Correct.
Of these classically large denominations that are not just rooted in the local church, but kind of a greater connection.
Yes.
Like you say, you have a bishop, and and that bishop, can they like move you then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so as United Methodist clergy, we are itinerant, meaning that we are subject to be moved at the will of the bishop from year to year.
Wow.
So basically what happens is we have a committee within the church, the local church, that we kind of have discussions between the pastor of the church and the committee as to come to a consensus.
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to continue our partnership in ministry together?
Okay.
Or is it time for a change?
Mm.
And that happens every year. So if the decision, if we come to the mutual decision, it's probably time for us to move on for new blood to come in, so to speak. Then that you would be moved and appointed to another local church within the conference. Now, sometimes it doesn't quite work like that, because sometimes you come to the mutual agreement that you're going to continue on in ministry together for another year, and you still get moved. And that's what happened. That's how I ended up here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the church, my previous appointment, the church where I was at before here, which was in the town of Logan, mm-hmm. in Logan County, we had mutually agreed that I would return for another year of ministry as their pastor. That happens, usually always happens in December. Our conference year begins in July. Mm. So between December and usually late April is when that's the appointment season, when mm-hmm. you find out where you're going,
okay.
where you're going to be moving to June.
Yeah.
And it's a funny story. A couple of weeks before I got this phone call, I was sitting in my living room watching TV one evening. I just had the thought run through my head, boy, I sure am glad I'm not moving this year. Couple of weeks later, the phone rings. It was my DS. First words out of his mouth was, "Are you sitting down?" Oh, no, at that point, I was like, oh, God.
Uh-oh. That means you're going to move.
It means I'm going to move. So, and that was the first week of May, so which is extremely late in the process.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So some things happened, that unforeseen things. That caused this appointment in this community to open.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up asking me to come, and I said yes, and that's how I ended up here. And this coming July 1st will be the beginning of my fourth year here.
Wow, okay. Yep. So, and does that mean that we could be getting closer to a move here?
It's possible. Normally, average is right around 4 or 5 years in one spot. My hope is, though, I hope that I'm here much longer than that.
Okay.
I would love, now I know because of our itinerant system, it's probably not possible and it's way beyond my control. But I would love to retire here. I would like for this to be my last appointment.
Oh.
Just quite honestly.
Sure, okay.
Because I feel beyond a shadow of a doubt that my work is here, that I'm called here to do the work of the church and to do the work of Christ, the work of God in this community.
Mm. That's powerful. I mean, you're really rooted. I think we were talking about before we even started about a sense of place and rootedness. And so here you are. I know one of the huge parts, it seems like, at least as I kind of fanboy on your social media and see some of the things you're saying and doing and all that, is that, justice is a huge part. Justice is a huge part of your spirituality.
Yes.
And being kind of a social justice minister. I mean, I know you see it as being a Christian.
Sure, yeah.
But some people might look at that and say, oh, he's one of these
social justice warriors.
Social justice warriors, woke guy.
Yeah.
And so just tell me about, like how did you connect with that? Like, what does that mean for you? What are the causes that are most important to you?
Yeah. So in my theological outlook, the way I understand God, and particularly God in Christ, is that, justice work is God's work.
Mm.
Justice work is evangelism. Justice work is the gospel.
Okay, that is a very helpful distinction, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like you're doing these things for the sake of, it's not like we're going to do this feeding of the hungry so that we can then preach the gospel. You really think that this justice work is the very substance of it.
Absolutely. And I think it was, I may be wrong, but I think it was Bishop Desmond Tutu that once said that, the gospel to a hungry person is bread.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
And Jesus, if you read the gospels, Jesus was very much concerned with the material needs of people. In fact, his whole ministry revolved around that, feeding people who were hungry, healing people who were sick, giving water to people who were thirsty.
Mm-hmm.
That casting out demons who were oppressing people and causing them to have all sorts of physical maladies, yeah. right? That was the crux of Jesus's ministry. That was the good news of God's kingdom,
yeah.
right? Giving a glimpse of God's coming kingdom in the here and now. And to me, that is addressing challenges in communities, addressing challenges with individuals, anything that is diminishing life in a community is a challenge that I feel like, anyway, the church is called to address.
So I want to come back to what you just said, yep. things that are diminishing life.
Correct.
Can you give me an example of what maybe what you see here in sure. your region?
Well, I mean, and I don't have to tell you this, but this historically is one of the most exploited, oppressed mm-hmm. regions in the country, socially, economically, politically, even religiously mm-hmm. to some extent. A lot of the work that I have been involved with, these churches and other groups that I am a part of mm-hmm. that have been involved with, for the last year in particular, is the fight for clean water
gotcha,
for these
okay.
communities.
So clean water.
Yeah, so three of the five communities that I have churches in are water-impacted communities, meaning that their water is either unusable or unreliable.
Wow.
So that is been that has really been the crux of my ministry for over a year now. Now, in addition to that, you've got mass poverty here. This mm-hmm. is one of the most impoverished places in America. All of these intersectional issues that all come together and form huge challenges for the people here that diminish life here. Now we know that Jesus said in John's gospel that he came to give life and to give it more abundance.
That's right, exactly.
So if that's the case, and we're followers of Jesus, and the church is the body of Christ continuing Jesus's ministry here on earth, then it's our calling, it's our responsibility to do all that we can to ensure that people have the opportunity to live that abundant life that Jesus came to give.
Well, you know, people would say, yeah, brother, that's all good, and that sounds like a bunch of social work, mm-hmm. Because really the goal is to get them to heaven. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's going to mm-hmm. be bad here, but let's just get on to heaven, and, you know, mm-hmm. that the end is going to come anyways and going to burn this place down, so let's just get on to glory. Yeah. And what do you say to that?
It's easy to say, right? And it's easy to talk about heaven or to look ahead towards going to heaven, but what do you say to people about going to heaven who are living in hell now?
Mm.
Who are living in hell on earth mm-hmm. right now? A future glory is not doing them any good in the present, right? So, and in my interpretation of the scriptures, when I read Revelation, particularly the end of Revelation, heaven comes down to earth.
Yeah.
The kingdom of God comes to earth. When the kingdom is culminates and comes in its fullness, it's going to be here. God's rule, God's reign, the way society is intended to be mm-hmm. ordered by God, that needs to happen. We need to start working on that now.
Mm.
To alleviate suffering here in the present.
Yeah.
Again, the way I feel like we see God most clearly on the cross.
Mm, yeah.
The biggest revelation or the most clear revelation of God is Jesus on the cross in his suffering.
Okay.
Right? And if that be the case, we see Jesus in the suffering of people and communities
yeah.
most clearly.
Yeah.
If you want to find God, if you're looking for God, you will find God up in these hollers where 40% of our kids are going hungry every day.
40%.
40%.
Yeah.
You will find God in these communities that cannot use their water. When they turn their taps on, the water is running brown and black and orange. That's where God is, because these people, like Jesus, have been crucified.
Yeah.
These are, you know, Ignacio Ellacuría would refer to the people of Central Appalachia as the crucified peoples of history.
Right. That's right.
And this God is seen, at least from my perspective, most clearly right here in these communities.
Yeah, I think what you just said is so, I mean, deeply profound and theologically deep, but also mind-blowing, because you'd think that what you're talking about is rural Guatemala or Ecuador or El Salvador. I mean, all these places, whatever country it is we have in our mind of, like, you know, people who don't have access to clean water, high poverty. You think we're talking about those, but you're talking about rural West Virginia.
America.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
2025 United States of America.
Wow.
Right? Yeah.
And of a place here in Welch, McDowell County, that you had said at one point, way back in the day, was referred to as what?
Little New York.
Because it was so booming.
Because it was so booming. You know, this is a community, a county, like the region, that was built on coal, right? And during coal's boom years, this place was you know, it had 100,000 people that lived in this county.
Wow.
Now it's somewhere around 17,000, approximately. So, this was a booming place at one time. And now, it's really because of a lot of factors, not the least of which is, you know, the continued decline of coal, and you know, these communities, in a real sense, and the people have been left behind, forgotten, abandoned, and they very much feel like that, and they're justified in feeling like that. But as I like to say, everybody else in the world may have forgotten about us, may have turned their backs on us, may have abandoned us, but God has not.
Amen. That'll preach.
God, exactly.
That'll preach.
God is right. God with us, right?
Yeah.
God with us. And again, if you're looking for God, look for where the suffering is the greatest.
Sure.
And suffering is great here. This is, don't get me wrong, this is a tremendous place. I love this place deeply. The people are the greatest people on earth. And that's why I'm so passionate and so committed to seeing a better world be built for this place, because they deserve it.
Well, you know, I have this image of, you know, all the cars fleeing out of here month by month, you know, like, you know, with the stereotypical kind of, like, everything loaded up on the car and off they go, they're getting out of here, you
sure,
know?
Yeah.
And everyone is fleeing, and either the highly educated and the highly employable are fleeing out of here, right?
The brain drain.
Yeah, the brain drain, and you know, the college, the young 22-year-old who just got out of Morgantown or whatever is now coming home and saying, oh my gosh, I gotta get out of here, you know? And any place that you see these people fleeing, it seems like God is running quicker too.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
But that begs a question of, you know, if Appalachia, particularly Central Appalachia, is this, like, really exploited place where, you know, timber, coal, whatever has been taken out of here. And, but I have a sense that, like, being an Appalachian American is really important to you.
Absolutely.
Like, what does that mean to be Appalachian, have a pride of place? What does that mean for you?
I think we are probably, I don't want to say we are the most unique people and place in the country, but among them anyway, in that, and I know I'm speaking for me, but my, just the deep connectedness and rootedness of place here is, I mean, we have just a unique connection to the land here. These hills. People that aren't from here, I like to explain to them that these hills to us, to me, is like a mother's embrace.
Okay.
And when you leave here, it's like leaving your family. It's like leaving your mother, right? Mm. And even now, if I go somewhere, if I go out of town for whatever reason, mm-hmm. to outside of the region and outside of the mountains, when I'm coming home and when I see those hills in the distance, and it's got, I know I'm home.
Mm.
And there's just, it's spiritual. Mm. It's a spiritual connection, I think, that we have to this place.
Okay. Yeah. All because of the mountains and just what you're familiar with.
Yeah. Yeah. And just I can remember as a kid, and to some extent, I still do this sometimes, but as a kid, and if you talk to folks from West Virginia, a lot of them will tell the same story, say the same thing. But if we were going on a trip, my family and I, it'd be in a car on an interstate somewhere, you pass a vehicle that had West Virginia license plates, you waved. We're family, right? We're all interconnected together.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a unique place. It really is.
Mountain people stick together.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I've noticed that when my students oftentimes will go off to grad school somewhere, I don't care, even if it's overseas, if they can find somebody from Central Appalachia, they become quick friends.
Absolutely.
And they're hanging out together.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing how that works. So now here, you know, as you pastor and as you preach and as you're serving people and you are involved in all these justice issues, do you ever take any flack from being so justice oriented? Is there any kind of cost to that for you?
There is always a cost involved in doing that type of ministry, that type of work. It cost Jesus his life.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
So right. Here, the people have been great.
Great.
Now, do I get pushback occasionally? Yes, and I think that's healthy.
Yeah.
I think if you're preaching the gospel, you're going to get pushback.
Yeah, sure.
You should get pushback.
Make them and you uncomfortable.
absolutely. Because Archbishop Oscar Romero once said, a word of God that doesn't unsettle. I'm paraphrasing here. What kind of gospel is that?
Yeah, there you go.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you're truly preaching the good news of God's kingdom or demonstrating it in your actions, you're going to cause some people to be unsettled.
Yeah.
Because the gospel is always rankling or running up against the status quo.
Mm.
Because God's kingdom is a complete inversion of the way society is, we feel like society is meant to function, mm-hmm. right? It's a complete inversion, uprooting, if you will, of the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
So anywhere the gospel is preached, anywhere the gospel of God's kingdom is demonstrated, there will be pushback. You will meet resistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I am perfectly, I have become very comfortable in that.
Gotcha.
Very comfortable in that.
Gotcha.
Now, I've learned that you cannot take that personally.
Okay.
I have in the past.
Sure.
But it's just, it goes with the territory.
Mm-hmm.
It goes with the territory.
Well, speaking of territory, you are embedded in a very concentrated, almost monocultural or monolithic political place,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is kind of quote unquote Trump country,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, overwhelming, 80-some% of people, probably more than that, have voted for Trump. I see lots of flags and, when we were driving over here today, just a lot of that stuff. And, but some of the stuff that you at least are indicating today may rub up against that kind of political framework.
Yeah.
Right. So what's it like right now to be a minister in a very politically conservative, Trump-favoring area, that some of your ideas and thoughts maybe kind of run against it. What's it like at this moment to be preaching the gospel?
Right. So I mentioned right at the top of our time together that this place is known as the Free State.
Yeah.
Right. And that stems from, there's two origins to that. Number one, back in the early 20th century, there was a vast number of black folks from this community who were elected to government positions. So that became, they started calling this the Free State because of that.
Wow.
But it also, one of the other origin stories of the name is just the independent nature, the independent spirit of the people here. And I say that to reference the uniqueness of the politics here.
Okay.
So yes, somewhere between 70 to 80%, I think it was 74% maybe.
Okay, good. Okay.
In the 24 election voted for Donald Trump for president. But what we have to keep in mind though when we look at that number is I think voter turnout was less than 30%.
Wow, okay. So those numbers could be a little
right. Yeah. And in 08, this county voted for Obama.
Yes.
Okay. So, yes, there has been a big swing. Mm-hmm. But I think there are far more, there's far more diversity of thought here than what meets the eye on the surface.
Okay, so maybe those numbers don't tell the whole story.
I think that's true.
Okay.
And I think that one of the reasons why voter turnout here is so low, and I think you'll find this in any place that suffers from a lot of impoverishment. Mm. People have given up on the system.
Mm.
People have given up on any politician from either party.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To make real change happen in this place. Because, you know, in West Virginia, up until I think it was 2014, we had a democratically controlled legislature, and for the most part, governorship for a lot of those years, for 80 years until 2014. But all of these challenges, all of these problems that we're facing now, all of them existed then too.
Sure, yeah.
Right? So I think that speaks volumes, the lack of voter participation speaks volumes into how, again, it gets back to that abandonment and forgotten issue mentality here. People feel like that it doesn't matter what letter is in behind your name, whether it's a D or an R, nothing ever changes. And when someone like Trump comes along who is promising a complete wreckage of the system, and it's almost like we're so desperate for something good to happen that when someone comes along and says, hey, I'm going to tear down the system and build something new, and also while I'm at it, by the way, I'm going to revitalize the industry that we feel like made us great.
Mm.
And with the industry that we feel like if it goes away, we go away.
Yeah, okay. Existential threat, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, let's ride with it.
Yeah, sure. All the other politicians have abandoned you, what do you got to lose?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's really interesting. You know, and you've talked about the decline, right? I mean, from 100,000 to 17,000, 16,000, whatever it is, and the coal industry has radically changed, and the machinery of all the industry now, and even in the mainline American tradition, there's been so many, you know, kind of one of the things we talked about earlier, part of your faith is being United Methodist, and even in the mainline, they don't hold the same power or prestige as like they used to, right?
Absolutely,
You moved into town, it's like, you know, one question, are you a Presbyterian, are you a Lutheran, are you a Methodist, right? Like, that was it. And I know that the Methodist Church, United Methodist Church, had their own let's move the Democrats and Republicans out of the way. They had their own major division.
Mm-hmm.
And what was that like for you, and something that you loved that was really close to your... I mean, it's one thing if in Washington they beat each other's brains out.
Sure.
But this is the church house.
Absolutely.
What was that like for you as a clergy person who loves the United Methodist Church? What was that like?
It's heartbreaking. Mm. And continues to be.
Mm.
Because, I mean, the dust has not settled from all of that yet.
Oh, really?
Right.
Okay.
So there's still, there's lawsuits going on. There's, you know, people, folks still trying to leave the denomination. It's heartbreaking. Mm. Because it really has been so divisive in so many ways, and cost friendships, and has been, quite frankly, a terrible witness of the church, a terrible witness of the faithfulness to God, and with blame on both sides, there more than enough blame on both sides to go around for that. It's been hard to watch. It really has. I'll give you an example of that. So, and you mentioned the declining influence of mainline churches. So back in 2019, the United Methodist Church called a special general conference to address the human sexuality issue, which is what we're talking about. The last day of that conference happened to be our on-campus day at MTSO.
Oh, okay.
So...
at your seminary.
At my seminary, Methodist Theological School in Ohio. So, needless to say, not a lot of attention was being paid in class that day. Everybody was paying attention to what's going on at General Conference. And for non-United Methodist folks, General Conference is a four-year gathering where all the decisions are made for the denomination.
Sure,
okay. This was a specially called one to deal just with this issue. On that final day, the final day of plenary, during the plenary session, there were security guards on the floor.
Wow.
To keep the peace. And we're watching that. And I remember saying in a group of folks, and we have the audacity to wonder why no one wants to be a part of who we are.
Yeah.
No, we have the audacity to wonder why our churches are declining, when this is the witness we're putting out to the world.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a huge statement, right? It's playing. Here you are. You're being trained to be, you know, ordained elder, something that you deeply love, to a people that you already feel like are forgotten. And then it's like the body that's supposed to uphold me and support me and inspire me is now got bodyguards so they don't beat each other up.
Yeah, the one institution in the world, the church, where every other institution and every other body should look towards on how love should be put in action.
Mm-hmm.
Sees strife and anger and hatred and division when they look towards us. And it's hard, that's why I say it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. So as you now, you know, as you get up, you mount the pulpit every Sunday morning, and as you preach to people that you love, what are, like, are there any spiritual practices that seem to be most, I don't know, invigorating, life-giving for you? What is there something that's most for you?
Sure. So I try to make it a point to stay grounded in the folks I refer to as my spiritual mentors.
Folks, the
writings of folks like Romero, the writings of Aya Correa, Ernesto Cardinal. The Gospel in Sola Tenente is, that's one of my go-tos, okay? So staying deeply connected with those folks, Howard Thurman, they inform me and my ministry, and really helped me to contextualize the gospel in this place. Because the things that they are talking about, Latin American liberation theologians, regardless of whether you're a campesino, a rural tenant farmer in Nicaragua, or a coal miner in central Appalachia, there's a connection. We're facing the same challenges, just in a different context. So they helped me greatly to keep that in focus and inform my theology and my ministry to these people and with these people greatly.
It's inspiring to kind of, plug into the, helpful materials. And like you say, people who maybe on the surface look really different, but actually when you get down to it, are struggles are very much the same, right?
Very much the same.
Yeah. Yep. So as we wrap up, I'm thinking about, people who, as they think about, they think about West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, and they're thinking about Christianity, and they think of the person who's, shouting from the pew or handling a snake or,
We got some of that here. Not in this church, but we got some of that here. Yeah.
But you're wearing a collar and the church seems a little bit more like ordered and structured, and you probably got a call and response. And like you say, the Lord be with you. People are going to be like, and also with you. And, and what would you say is the appeal to a worship that is maybe a little bit less driven by spontaneity and emotion per se? I mean, I'm not saying that the United Methodist Church isn't filled with emotion. I don't mean that. But what would you say is an appeal to that?
Right. Well, as I like to say, particularly with the more liturgical aspects of the way we worship, particularly here at First Church where we're sitting now, that call and response is simply a reflection of God's call towards us and our response to God, and really puts in focus and puts right in front of us the emphasis of God's grace and the way God is always moving towards us, calling us, and is continually awaiting our response. So that's what I would say to that. Now, interestingly enough, First Church, where we are now, is the only church where I operate like that.
Oh, okay.
Because my other four churches are far smaller in congregation.
Yeah.
So our Sunday worship there is modeled much more along the lines. It's kind of a hybrid between a Wesleyan class meeting, a base ecclesial community, and a new monastic, with a new monastic twist to it.
And
the preaching is dialogical.
Gotcha.
We for that day's text, we engage very much like the base communities in Latin America.
Yeah, yeah.
We engage in the discussion of that day's text, with the goal being, the intention being, to create space for those folks to contextualize the gospel. To see the connection between those original, what I like to call, freedom stories in the Gospels, because that's what they were, right? Connect that to our struggle, the struggles that were going on then, to our struggles here. Now, what does the good news have to say to us in 2025 McDowell County? And what's our response?
Yeah. Okay, so you get
and
that.
And what's our response?
Yeah, that call response.
How do we respond to the challenges that we face in light of the gospel? I even take it back to Vatican II. Right? the church's task coming out of the Roman Catholic Church's task, but I co-opted and put it in United Methodist terms as well. The church's main task is to interpret the signs of the times mm-hmm. in light of the gospel. And that's what those Sunday morning gatherings in those smaller churches are all about.
I mean, being hyper-flexible to meet the people where they're at.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now the big issue you're working on right now is water. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of the biggest justice issue you're working on?
That's the biggest challenge, I think, right now. And as well as, you know, we just experienced, as did you all, major flooding back in February. Flood relief / recovery has become a big deal for us as well over here.
So really, it's water related in a different way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And if you were to like send people away with one thing about the ongoing water situation, what should they know?
That no person, no human being created in the image of God, regardless of where they live on the planet, let alone in the richest country mm-hmm. in the history of the world in 2025, should have to be concerned about what comes out of their tap when they turn their faucet on. Hmm. All people, because we all are created in God's image and we are all deeply cared for and loved by God, mm-hmm. all because of that, every single human being deserves access to clean water. And we will not stop until the people of McDowell County and in a larger sense, Central Appalachia, mm-hmm. have that access. Because again, that gets back to that abundant life we were talking about. Mm. God's intention for humanity is for humanity to flourish.
Yeah.
Humanity cannot flourish without clean water. It's the essential of life.
Yeah.
It's the essential element of life.
Oh. So I guess you really are you're hoping to baptize everyone in clean water, right?
Absolutely.
That's amazing. Well, I really appreciate your work here. Like we've talked about today, you know, Welch is not a place. There's probably a lot of people beating down the door to try to, you know, in the United Methodist Church overall in the world, they're probably not thinking, man, I wait till Brad retires, 'cause I'm going to run to Welch and take over these places, you know?
historically, it's been a major problem is getting clergy down to this part of the state.
Yeah, I believe it.
It's always been a major issue. And my way of thinking, if you are serious about ministry, where else would you want to be?
Yeah.
I mean, honestly.
Because this is right where God's running, right?
This is where God is. Again, yeah, God is right here.
Well, I admire what you're doing. I really appreciate it. Appreciate you spending your time with us today. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Yep. It was great. Great talking to you. I know that it makes you sad when I simply don't know.